With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem-solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
You are listening to episode 8 of the Tennis Files podcast, Life on the Futures Tour with Colin Johns.
Welcome to the Tennis Files podcast, bringing you advice from the top minds in tennis to help you improve your game. And now, here's your host, Mehrban Iranshad.
Hey guys, welcome to the Tennis Files podcast. For those of you who are new, welcome to the show. And for those of you who are returning, thank you. You're awesome. I hope everybody here is getting to play as much tennis as possible. That's kind of warming up, at least around here on the East Coast, where I am in Maryland. So, I hope you all are improving your game and just trying to absorb as much information as you can. I have a cool story for you guys. I actually went to visit one of my former coaches this past weekend at the Aspen Hill Club in Silver Spring, Maryland, and I was sitting and observing a lesson that he was giving to one of his students when somebody looked at me. It's a random person in the club and said, "Hey, I like your blog." And I thought that was really cool. Just kind of showing how the stuff that I'm doing is reaching at least one person. It's reaching people and helping them out. And it was definitely pretty cool to have that happen. So Yvette, shout out to you. Thanks so much for listening to the show and for recognizing me and my mug. So, but today we have a great show for you. I know a lot of people are really interested in how futures tournaments work. So they're, you know, like the beginning phases of a professional player's career, when they work their way up the ladder from the futures to the challenger tournaments and then up to the biggest events. So we have for you Colin Johns, who is a native of Maryland and who I met through my good friend and former neighbor, Peter. Hello to you, Peter. And it was just a great connection because he is a very unique player, as you'll see in the interview, as his playing style. Well, you know, the way he hits his shots, I guess I'll say. You'll find out about that later. And really cool to hear about his upbringing and different ways he trained when he wasn't around a tennis court, as well as just his meteoric rise from starting tennis, you know, pretty late, and how he went from just a pretty average junior career to playing at the highest levels of the game. So you'll learn a lot about his career and specifically the futures circuit and how that all works and how tough it is to grind out points on the tour. So without further ado, I bring you my interview with ATP Pro Colin Johns. I hope you really enjoy it. Hey, everybody. We're here with Colin Johns, professional tennis player. He's 22 years old, originally from Maryland, and he primarily plays on the Futures Tour. And he's been playing professionally for, is it about 3 years now, Colin?
Yeah, that's right.
Awesome. And Colin has really had a cool, experience on the tour. He's picked up ATP points in really awesome places like South Africa, Israel, Mexico, Nicaragua. And I wanted to bring him on the show today to just give you a glimpse into the life of players on the Futures Tour and overall professionally. Colin, thanks again for being on the show. How's everything going today?
Oh, great. Thanks for having me on.
Cool. Yeah, I really appreciate it. Colin is actually a friend of one of our mutual friends, Peter. And so it was really cool of Peter to, suggest that Colin be on the show. And it's really, really happy to have him.
Peter's a good friend and I've known him for a while.
Yeah, he's definitely a great dude. So, Colin, I guess with that, we'll just kind of delve into your career. So kind of tell us how you first got into playing tennis.
I actually started quite late. I was a baseball player growing up, and I actually didn't pick up tennis till I was 14 years old, and I just discovered it on vacation, and I really fell in love with it right away. Started playing more and more, but I still play baseball pretty much full time until I was 16, where I eventually quit to focus on tennis, and started with some local tournaments, eventually progressed to a few nationals, and trained a little bit, looked at some colleges, and decided to try it on the tour after that.
Well, it's amazing how late you started and where you are now. I guess two questions come up from that. One is, do you think your baseball training helped you transition pretty well to tennis?
Yeah, there are definitely some similarities. I was a pitcher, so that there are a lot of parallels between pitching and say, serving, and just the one-on-one aspect, which I liked. And the strategy, and I just loved it right away.
That's awesome, Colin. And as far as your progression, again, like you mentioned that you were able to get into national tournaments a couple years after you started, which is, really sick. I mean, how exactly, what do you attribute to that meteoric rise, if you will?
Really a love of the game and just a lot of practice. Because I loved it so much, I wanted to be on the court as much as possible. And my parents are really supportive from the start. And I picked up a different way of playing. Since coming over from baseball, I didn't really know tennis very well. I didn't get coaching early on. So I started out with a one-handed backhand, a two-handed backhand. And then I went to a one-handed backhand and then back to a two-handed backhand. And my dad, he didn't know tennis at all, but he's like, you know what? Everyone's backhand seems to be worse than their forehand. Why doesn't someone just hit two forehands? I mean, people switch hit in baseball. And we sort of talked about it. I thought about it. And one day I just started fooling around with it in our backyard. My dad had actually leveled our backyard into a dirt court. And we got a ball machine. And that whole summer, I would just hit on the dirt court left-handed, even though I'm a completely right-hand dominant person. And I sort of fooled around with it in the beginning. I stuck with it, and I started using it in practice pretty quickly. And I've been using it ever since then. So I feel like it's just a different sort of style of play, and a lot of practice brought me up pretty quickly.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Yeah, I mean, that's really unique, obviously. It's funny because I talked to Tim from Sports World, who is also a mutual friend of ours, and he told me once he heard that I was going to interview you to ask you about the one-handed forehand and backhand. So what are some pros and cons, in your opinion, of having, the one-handed backhand?
The lefty forehand?
Or, I'm sorry, lefty forehand, yeah.
Yeah. I'd say there are a lot of pros that I can think of, like the extra reach, of course, the extra leverage, and people typically can hit a forehand harder and with more spin than a backhand, and also the difference, because you're not used to playing against two forehands. It sort of baffles people sometimes in the beginning, and it can get you up early, and I'm not sure. It's just that's about all I can think of.
Yeah, no, that's great. That's great. Yeah, I mean, it's just, I love the logic too, because I mean, it is very true that like it pretty much almost everyone's forehand is stronger than their backhand. So why not do it? And so if you had to do it all over again, would you have a lefty forehand?
Yeah, absolutely. It was very difficult in the beginning. That was one of the things that I think more people would do it if it wasn't so difficult in the beginning. Mm-hmm. And you really got to stick with it. And I didn't really have much to lose because I didn't have a good backhand in the beginning. A lot of people that have been playing for years are like, well, why would I change to a lefty forehand? I would be terrible. But my backhand was so bad in the beginning. I'm like, well, what do I have to lose? It's going to be just as bad from the start anyway. And I think that it was a good decision to stick with it.
Yeah, that's awesome. I mean, it's funny because a lot of people try to teach the two-handed backhand by saying, oh, like, you know, hit a bunch of lefty forehands because it's lefty dominant for the right-handed backhand. So why not just do a lefty forehand?
So,
that's pretty cool. And I guess going back to your junior career, I'm wondering what point in your junior career did you begin to really move up the ranks, and like how did that work out for you?
I started playing tournaments fairly quickly, in 14, just some local tournaments, very, very low level. And by the time I was up into the 16, I graduated out of the 16 and unders, about 25 in our section, in the Mid-Atlantic section, was Maryland, Virginia, D.C., and West Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
So I was still obviously not that good. Then I moved up into the 18s, still playing only local junior tournaments, so some of the higher level ones by that point. And I actually finished number two in the section in the 18s. And that allowed me to play some of the higher level nationals because I qualified off my sectional ranking, and I was lucky enough to qualify for the clay courts in Florida and Kalamazoo, which was sort of the big tournament in the U.S. for juniors, which is a really cool experience. And I got to go and even win a match. So I was just happy to be able to play in them at that point. It was just really cool. And from there, I started looking at some schools, maybe to play college tennis. And that year, they had changed the rule where you could only take off 6 months between your high school graduation and when you got enrolled in college. Otherwise, you would start to lose eligibility.
Hmm.
So I was the first year affected by that, which was sort of unfortunate because I wanted to play as much as possible after I decided to take a year off, which some other people had done. And I could only play tournaments for 6 months after. Otherwise, I would have lost the eligibility. So I did that. I would have been young enough to play junior tournaments because I graduated fairly early for past the 6 month period, but then I had to stop and just train. And I kept looking at schools, and I just decided to wait, and I wanted to see how I'd fare in the pros after that. So that's pretty much where I've been the last two or three years.
Yeah, Colin, very interesting about the 6 month rule. I definitely didn't know that, and I'm sure a lot of other people don't. So, I mean, I guess looking back on that, I guess another reflective question, like, are you happy with, you know, the choice to go for it? Because, I mean, obviously you don't always get a chance, like you can look back on and say, oh, I wish I had gone to college. Or alternatively, you can, if you went to college, you could say, oh, I wish I tried for the tour. So, I mean, you know, you're pretty pleased with your decision.
Yeah, absolutely. You're only young enough to play pro tennis once, but you can always go to college. And, that's what my parents have been very supportive about it, and I feel like if it doesn't work out on the tennis tour, I can always go back to school. So I'd like to go for it while I can, and I've enjoyed it every step of the way.
Yeah, that's great. And yet, you know, I'm looking into your record, you've moved up, you know, hundreds of spots within the last few years. So it's definitely liking the progression. I'm sure you'll keep going up. And so I get you touched on this a little bit, but maybe you can even more. A lot of people look on tennisrecruiting.net these days and they're like, oh, this guy's a 3-star, he's a 5-star, he's a blue chip. So what was cool for me is I looked you up on tennisrecruiting.net and you were a 3-star. You know, I guess you are now on it or whatever. But
mm-hmm.
As far as your training, what do you think was the most important aspect of your training that propelled you to the elite levels of tennis from that 3-star quote status?
You definitely don't see too many pro players with the 3-star rating. It's pretty unusual because usually they start at 4 years old and they're phenoms growing up. They're topping the juniors and so on.
Right.
Usually 5-star blue chips or beyond, where they have rankings when they're very young. So that's definitely unusual, and I would just attribute it to a lot of practice. I always loved it so much. I would want to be on the court for 6, 7, 8 hours. I mean, until I literally couldn't swing the racket anymore. I would be practicing, and sticking with the lefty forehand. I feel like that's helped me a lot to be different, and some great people helped me along the way. Coaches, my parents, always my brother, and it's just a lot of hard work and practice, and sticking with it.
And so this may be hard to quantify for you, but would you say it was mostly, yeah, like your training, is it mostly drilling, or is it mostly like competitive sets? Or I'm just trying to figure out like what maybe maximized your development, or maybe it was just everything.
I would say it was a little bit of everything. I always loved tournaments, competitive person, and I always found those to be the most fun. But at the same time, you want to drill and make yourself better so that you can do better in the tournaments. So I've done a lot of everything, a lot of different sort of unusual things in my training, sort of unorthodox since I started late, and I didn't really do really full-time training right away. So my dad would come up with funny things where I'd practice my serve in the driveway because we didn't have a court or anything, but sort of a big driveway. And he created a service cage, which, try to explain it. It's the bottom bar was about the height of the net. Hmm. And the top bar was maybe a foot or two above that. And we had gone to the court, and he measured how high over the net the ball would go and still go in.
Wow.
And then we put the bar right at that level so that we knew, okay, if you clear the net above that first bar, but it's below the other bar in that window, if you will, then the serve would be in. So that allowed me to practice my serves just in the driveway in the beginning when I wouldn't have otherwise had access to a court so easily. And just fun stuff like that where I would just serve on that for an hour or two, and I wouldn't even realize how much better I was getting until I went to the court, and I'm like, wow, this really helps. Or just one winter, we have a barn on our property in Maryland, and we put up some hay bales as the net and bring the ball machine in, and the barn was just wide enough to be a tennis court, but it wasn't long enough, so I would just hit volleys over the hay bales and practice volleys like that. So sort of unorthodox things that I feel helped me in the end, and stuff that sort of behind the scenes.
Wow, Colin, I mean, that's really incredible. I just, you know, love the improvisation, and major props to Mr. Johns for constructing that, you know, whole apparatus thing that you used. That's really cool. I mean, I love how, you know, you find creative ways to train. Even if you don't have access to courts, you can find other ways to practice your game. I mean, personally, I live in an apartment right now, and I actually go to the parking garage, and just practice my strokes and serve down there. Hopefully, I'm not waking up anybody, but because you do it at night. But yeah, just awesome stuff. So, well done on that. So now shifting to the Futures Tour. So I guess for listeners who don't really know too much about the Futures Tour, can you kind of describe what that's all about?
Yeah, I'd say the best comparison would be the minor leagues of baseball, where you're fighting it out in the lower levels, just trying for points, certainly not making money, and just trying to accumulate enough points to get to that next level, which would be challengers, and then eventually lower level ATP events. So to put it in perspective to people who don't really know much, a Grand Slam has 2,000 points if you win the tournament, and a Futures tournament, if you win the tournament, you get 27 points. Even 18 points if it's a lower level. At the lowest level, it would be 18 points, and just 1 point if you win one round in the Futures Tour. So it's definitely a long ways below what you aspire to get to, but it's the first rung of the ladder, and that's where you see everyone start at. I mean, even the guys that are at the top of the game now, Nadal and so on, they played their first tournaments probably when they were 14, 15, of course, but that's the first level that of the pros that you would start at.
That's a great summary of the Futures Tour. Yeah, and when mentioning all the greatest starting there, I mean, I do remember reading something about Nadal where he was vying for his first ATP point, and then he got kind of nervous and lost in three sets and like a third set tiebreak or something. He was really disappointed, mm-hmm. but eventually he got, obviously, points and much more. So yeah, I mean, the Futures Tour is really a grind, and I mean, everyone starts somewhere, obviously, and so that's tough. And there's also, I guess, qualification rounds if you know, if needed to get into the main draw.
Yeah, in the beginning, of course, you come through the qualifying and just to get into the main tournament, And so you're not vying for any points for a few rounds. And some of these, the qualifying is by no means easy. You have to beat some ranked people. And especially, early in the year, the qualifying can be quite difficult. You see some players that were more highly ranked in there. They got injured or whatnot. And, still many, many good players you have to beat just to get into the main tournament.
Yeah, and a couple of questions on that. I have seen, like, it's kind of weird for me, some of these players who are actually like, they actually play the qualification round and then they end up being like seeded number one in the main draw. Is that just because they've registered late to the tournament? Or
yeah, that's okay. Exactly right. Yeah, they would have been direct acceptances if they had registered on time. But either they forgot or they just decide to go late. And what you can do is you can sign in for the qualifying. And if there aren't enough people to fill it, then you'll be the number one alternate to get in. And then you just have to win a few matches and get into the main draw, which they usually do because they're highly ranked. And then they'll come in to the main draw as a qualifier, but actually get seeded. So you see that from time to time.
Interesting. Thanks for explaining that, Colin. And so I guess the purses for these tournaments, the prize money is usually either 10K or 15K. Is that right?
They actually raised the prize money this year. This past year, that's what it was. It was 10s and 15s. This year they've raised the 15s to 25Ks, and next year they'll be raising the 10s to 15s. So it's been a long time since they've increased prize money at this level, but they finally did it a little bit. So that's helpful for the players for sure.
Yeah, I mean I'm really glad that they're at least raising the money, the stakes, because I mean, it's tough. You know, there's a lot of costs associated with playing on the Futures Tour and I guess, professionally overall. I guess, can you describe some of the major costs associated with playing on the tour, on these tournaments?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a very costly sport, of course, because you're playing against players all over the world and you have to travel to these tournaments to get points. And, of course, you have the flights, the hotel, because some tournaments have what's called plus H plus hospitality, where they'll pay for your hotel, or nice. they'll give you housing, but those are rare, so you usually have to foot the bill with the hotel, and as well as food when you get there, and stringing, because you can't really bring your stringing machine with you unless you get a mini portable one, which a few guys do, and then of course you have to pay for your strings unless you have a string sponsor, rackets, and just other little things. Of course, taxi from the airport, and just anything associated with traveling, or a buses across the country. You try to save money like that, but the primary cost is the flights and the hotel. And of course, if you wanted to travel with a coach, that would make it much more costly. And that you don't see that as much because of the cost, unless the federation of the country is paying for it, or they have a wealthy sponsor or something like that, just because of the cost that it would take to have a coach travel with you full time.
Interesting. Yeah, I was just about to ask you about the coaching aspect, but you pretty much read my mind. So do you you ever try to split costs with players? You like staying in the same hotel room or something like that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You meet friends, you see at the tournaments a lot, and I have some of my best friends that are from all over Australia, Israel, Germany, and all over. And you get to see them at the tournaments, you room together and play doubles together, and that's a fun part of it, definitely to help the cost as well. And it makes traveling a lot easier if you got someone to keep you company.
That's awesome. And another thing is, so I recognize that you're like right around, like, hovering around 1,000, mm-hmm. which, I mean, it's extremely tough in itself to even get to that point. So how many points is that around?
Right now, I think I have 8 points, and that puts me a little over 1,000 in the world. So it's difficult for sure. Just because you win matches doesn't mean you'll be up ranked high right away. You gotta not just win some matches, but win a lot of matches and make it deep into tournaments to really break into that top 1,000 or top 500 more so. So even if you do well, you still got to do even better.
Yeah, for sure. And I don't want to like crush people's dreams, but I mean, I just want to emphasize that it is extremely tough to get one ATP point. I mean, you see like some threads online about how like, oh, I'm a 4 or 5. Like, can I get an ATP point? But I mean, it's like these players are the best in the world. A lot of them are like top college players, and even to get 1 point against, like, you know, in these tournaments is extremely difficult. So I mean, and you've got to go through qualies, like Colin said, and so it's, you know, it's not easy. So what is the most important thing that you've learned playing in these futures tournaments on how to succeed?
It's a lot mental, and going into each match, not taking it for granted because everyone's good. There are no easy matches out there. Just staying mentally tough throughout the matches, and going in prepared, being as prepared as you can be, because the conditions are often not the greatest. But whether the courts or it's windy or the weather, or it's always something every week, and you got to be able to adjust to it and do what you can with what you have.
I appreciate that advice. And, you know, speaking of different court conditions and things like that, have you found some futures tournaments to be, you know, in like really pretty subpar conditions? Have you been in any crazy, like any tournaments that you can describe?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, definitely. If most people watch the US Open or Wimbledon, where courts are pristine and they're living the life, but in the futures it's anything but. Where I mean, you got cracks in the court. It's one tournament I went to in Mexico. They had just painted the court, not resurfaced the court, but wow, just painted it 3 days before. So as we were playing on the court, the paint was coming off, and the court was very slippery. It was sort of like dust. And then one of the tournaments in Israel, they were having a sandstorm the week of the tournament. And there was dust all over the court, and it's really slippery. And other courts with cracks, some clay courts that resemble more like an ice skating rink. They're so slippery, and just crazy stuff that you'd only see at that level that people don't really realize. But everyone's playing in the same conditions, so you just try to think of it that way, and try to do the best with what you have.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, to be honest, pretty funny, those stories. But I mean, like you said, you just have to grind, and it's the same for everybody. So you just got to do your best and persevere so you can reach the next level. And actually, you know, sorry to jump back a tiny bit to the prize money portion, but in my opinion, it seems like they're not really paying too much for, you know, all the work that you guys put in. I mean, it's tough, I guess. But, you know, if you like win a couple rounds, say you make the quarters, isn't that only like a few hundred bucks? Or I mean, what's the usual payout?
Yeah, it's pretty low. And it's sort of sad that it's not more, because it's definitely not easy to get to this level. We're very, very top percentile of tennis players, and not getting much back. I mean, it's hard. It's a tough solution, but the top player, it's very top heavy. The prize money. I mean, most of the prize money goes to the top 100 players and the top 200 players. To make a living, you got to be at least top 200, and to make a good living, you have to be top 50. If you make the quarterfinals of a futures tournament, you get, after tax, maybe between $300, $400. Hmm. Certainly not more. And first round loss would leave you with maybe $100. So even if you win the tournament, maybe $1,000 after tax. So that's not going to get you far with your travel and everything you need to pay for. So the next level of challenger is a little better. You can start to make a little bit. But a lot of players have to do other things where they play money tournaments where the money's a little better, try to make some that way, or teach when they're at home. And it's really tough with the money. You're not really going to make money at this level. You're really out there for the points, and just trying to get to that next level where you can start to make some money and work your way up.
Yeah, I mean, it's just so difficult. And I mean, if you think about it, like for some players have to support themselves through teaching. So I mean, then that lessens the availability for their training schedule, and it's, you know, more stress on them. And I mean, it's really tough. But you know, I think an argument that some people have made, I forget if the ITF made that too, is like, I guess it's kind of the lower prize money is partially to maybe weed out those who don't, I guess, who they think won't make the higher levels. I don't know, but I guess in general, like, do you think I mean, do you think that the pay structure should be, you know, even higher? Or, I mean, what are your thoughts kind of on the whole thing? I mean, they're trying, but...
They're trying. There's been a long debate over that with the players talking about it in the ITF and the ATP. And you can see where they're coming from. I mean, the futures, we don't get many spectators, very rarely, and yeah, it's tough to get sponsors and stuff. But the level of play is quite good. I mean, there are guys that have played in Grand Slams that you'll see in these tournaments that are the seeds, or guys that are working their way up that you'll see playing on TV someday. So I think if you really think about it, investing a little bit more, even a little bit more, would go a long way. Just to double the prize money or something like that would help enormously. I think that they could do it, and it would help to maybe produce some players that would not have otherwise made it, and that end up quitting because they run out of funds. So I think it's a tough question, but at least the ITF is moving in the right direction, raising the prize money a little bit. Certainly hope that they'll do more in the future.
Yeah, I definitely think so too. I mean, it's a tough situation, but hopefully if they can keep moving in this direction, that would be great. What are some other things you think can be done to make things better for the players in futures and challenger tournaments, if any?
The raising money would help a lot, as well as providing more tournaments with hospitality or housing, because that cuts out the hotel and the housing cost. Which does help a lot, especially if it's in a country where the hotel is quite expensive. Possibly helping out some more players whether it's the federation from the country or providing them with some training some of the year. The USTA does do that for some American players, but it's mostly the high end players that they feel are have a chance to someday be top 100 it's very sort of an elitist mindset. It's less so in some other countries, but the USTA is finally doing a little bit more where they're going to try to help some top 500 players. But I think that would help to bring up a lot more players and more of a to raise the level for everyone rather than just focus on the top.
Right. Yeah, and I did hear that they're building, I guess, a new USTA like huge facility in Orlando or something like that, and I don't know. I was wondering if maybe like you think you would train there. Have you heard anything about that? Or
yeah, that it's a very, very large facility that they're building now. I think it's supposed to be done near the end of the year, this year. I haven't heard a whole lot about the training opportunities there. They're moving their whole national center there from Boca Raton, where it is right now. But hopefully they'll be more inclusive to some lower ranked players, and obviously love to get some better training, because a lot of players struggle with that, where they have one or two other guys that they can practice with and maybe a coach. But it's very divided throughout the country. Obviously, the U.S. is a big country. It's easier if it's a smaller country like Spain, where you can travel to a couple places that have a lot more players to train with and such. But hopefully it'll make it more centralized with this new center, and it's supposed to be really nice with a lot of courts, and we'll see how it goes.
Yeah, that'd definitely be awesome. And you're in Florida right now. Like, are you training in a specific academy or something like that, or just kind of with your friends? Or
there are a couple players in the area that come in and out, but right now I'm primarily with my coach. He played on the tour and still does a little bit. Jesse Witten made the U.S. Open third round a few years back and lost in four sets to Djokovic. So he's got up to 160 in the world. So very, very good player, and he's coaching me right now, and it's been going well. So working with him mostly.
Oh, that's awesome. It's great to have Jesse as your coach. I remember, actually, I think I was a ball kid at the 18 Clays in D.C. for his match when he played in the finals. And I think did he play in Kentucky?
Yeah, he played 4 years at Kentucky.
Right. And if I'm not mistaken, I can't remember, but there was a video, I think, with him and another player where it was like 6-5 in the third set, five serving six, and the guy, they called a foot fault on the guy, and he went berserk. I don't know if you saw that YouTube video, but I think it was his match.
I don't think I've seen it. Okay. I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. But I also do want to ask you, what are like a couple of your favorite point patterns that you utilize, you know, to win points?
Oh, yeah, sure. You definitely look to perfect your patterns because it gives you something to really look for before the point starts. Keep it simple and that you can just run over and over. That work over and over. One would be just to kick the ball wide in the ad court since I'm right-handed, and that usually gets them off the court. You get something in the middle and pull the ball the other side of the court, keep them on the run. Or same thing on the other side where you slice it wide, get them off the court, and then you can play behind them or at the open court. Those are two of the typical ones. Or maybe you jam them to the body and get something in the middle and play behind with the open court. Just always, especially off your serve, you look for those patterns. And even off the return, where it's sort of predictable on the second serve, if he's going to kick it to the tee, then you take it early, and you come in behind it and look for the certain volley to a certain place. But the patterns are very important, and I think it's something a lot of club players don't really look for that they could. And it'll help anybody. I mean, it'll help Federer, it'll help the club player just to really know what your patterns are and to execute them better and better as you pick up on when you can play them more and more.
That's awesome. I really appreciate that. And I guess before your matches, do you kind of study your opponents if you can and try to figure out strategically like the optimal way to play them and things like that and then execute it in a match?
Yeah, definitely. Some players are more where they just like to focus on themselves and like, oh, I'll make him adjust to me. And other guys like to study them and how you're going to play the guy you're going to play in the next round. I'm a little bit of both, where I like to see how my opponent plays, where one side is clearly weaker or if he has a weak second serve or something, where you can go in thinking, okay, maybe I exposed that. But you also don't want to get caught up in that too much, where you're focusing on his game and not your game, and you gotta make him adjust to you.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, I think with most things, like a happy medium is the best. So that's great.
Yeah,
that's awesome. And if you could tell us maybe like a couple of the most important things mentally that that help you perform at your best, like mental attitudes and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, preparation is a key part of that. Know that you're going into the match as prepared as you can be. That gives you a lot of confidence. And just to stay calm no matter what is thrown at you, because a lot of things in futures won't always go your way. In the qualifying, so you call your own line. So sometimes you have people trying to take calls. Mm-hmm. Or even in the main draw where the chair umpire is giving calls to the local guy, or they're just making genuine errors. But there are many things that can be frustrating. You just got to stay mentally strong and just stick with it.
That's really awesome advice. So, last couple questions for you. So, Colin, what's your plan to break into the Challenger Tour? I mean, what do you think that you need to do that?
A couple things, just small things, because I feel like I'm really close. I've had a lot of three setters, especially last year against some higher ranked guys. And this past week, I was playing in the futures and played a couple of higher ranked guys. One of them was top 300. I went three sets and I had some chances. So just some little things, maybe get the serve a little bit bigger, get a little bit stronger, a little bit fitter. And I feel like I'm right there. I have the game to beat them. It's just getting the experience and making the most of your opportunities.
It's awesome. And last question for you, Colin. You know, usually like to close with like one piece of advice for our audience. So what would you say to everyone who wants to improve their tennis game? What's one thing that you'd tell them that they need to focus on or do?
I would say learn the fundamentals really well as early on as you can, which is really important for someone like me, because I didn't have that base, because I didn't start when I was really, really young. So every time you do something wrong, you're enforcing a bad habit. But if you can get it right from the start, then you're enforcing a good habit. So I would say learn the fundamentals early on, so you don't have to correct bad habits later. And that'll go a long way, and you'll help yourself a lot in the long run that way.
Awesome. It's very much appreciated. Can you just let us know if there's any social media pages you have or any other places that you'd like people to, you know, contact you or view anything that you have, I guess, online or whatever?
I don't really have anything like that right now. No really social media pages. I have some friends that do. I haven't really done that yet. Maybe at some point, but no, I appreciate that, but don't have anything as of now.
Oh yeah, no worries, man. Well, I really appreciate your time, Colin. It's really wonderful to get your viewpoint on the Futures Tour and just your insight into your career and how you really a very impressive rise from starting the game at 14 to being on the professional tour and taking these guys or top 300 to the limit. It's super impressive. So thanks so much for being on the Tennis Files podcast, and I encourage everybody to follow Colin's rise and his pretty unique lefty forehand game. And, I hope to maybe see you in Maryland sometime, Colin. So I just wish you all the best, and thanks a lot for your time today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on.
All right. Thanks a lot, Colin.
You got it.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Tennis Files podcast with Colin Johns. I hope you learned a lot from hearing about Colin speak about his career and how he was able to rise quickly from a pretty average junior career to the elite levels of the sport. And I hope you in particular really enjoyed his thoughts and experiences playing on the Futures Tour. If you guys want to check out the show notes for this episode, you can do that by going to tennisfiles.com/8. And if you want these episodes of the Tennis Files podcast to be downloaded immediately to your podcast app as soon as I publish them, I would encourage you to subscribe to the Tennis Files podcast. And you can do that in iTunes by going to tennisfiles.com/iTunes, clicking the blue View in iTunes button, and then clicking subscribe. And you can also subscribe in other podcast apps by just finding that subscribe button in the app that you're using. So I definitely appreciate that. And I just want to leave you with a quote from Johann Wolfgang von Goethe, who was a famous German writer and statesman. He said something very powerful. "Things which matter most must never be at the mercy of things which matter least." So I think remembering these words will help you prioritize and figure out, you know, really what are the things that are going to push you forward to your goals, to reach them. And then what won't really help you reach your goals, and then try to eliminate the latter as much as possible. So I want you guys to just focus on doing the things that will help you the most. And I really look forward to hearing from you guys about how you're improving your tennis game. And as always, if you have any questions about tennis at all, feel free to message me. My email is mehrban@tennisfiles.com. So that's MEHRBAN at tennisfiles.com. So again, thanks so much for listening, guys. I look forward to serving you and helping you improve your tennis game. And I will see you on the next episode of the Tennis Files podcast. Take care, everyone.
Thanks for listening to the Tennis Files podcast. For more tips to help you improve your tennis game, visit tennisfiles.com.